Now it's time for Believe It.
Believe it. I don't even know if I believe.
Now I'm a believer.
Or not. Believe it or not. On the Jeff Calkins Show.
Tennessee coach Jeremy Pruitt is ready to play games with fans in the stands.
Believe it or not.
Jeff, I do believe that because he said so himself.
He did, really.
Yes, sir.
Let's hear.
Hey, Vol Nation, this is Jeremy Pruitt. I hope you and your family are safe now. I'm really looking forward to football season. I can't wait to see Neyland Stadium full again. Please renew your season tickets to come support our Vols. Our team is working extremely hard, and they're excited about the season. Be safe and go Vols.
In fairness, he didn't say when.
He said, we're all looking forward to
seeing Neyland
Stadium.
I just can't wait to see Neyland Stadium.
I can't either. Like, I'm with him there. Here's what's interesting is the John McCullers interview on this radio show had real repercussions. Like, people heard it. People knew about it. That's throughout the SEC. They knew about it. At Tennessee, they knew about it. And I don't think it's an accident. Now, mind you, they're just trying to get people to renew their season tickets, right?
Yes.
That's what they're trying to do. That's what was happening there. But what did McCullers said, Tennessee, literally it was last week he said, there's not going to be fans in Neyland Stadium, I can tell you that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so within several days, we have I can't wait to see Neyland Stadium full again. Like, people really did hear that interview and reacted and were bitter about it, honestly. Even though it was a throwaway line at the end of an interview about how Memphis is doing. And it was not, he was very clear, he does not have control over that. But it is interesting. And in fairness to Jeremy Pruitt, again, he didn't say we're going to have fans there week one.
Yeah, wait to see in September.
He didn't say can't wait to see. Exactly. He didn't say can't wait to see in September. Oh, in terms of the SEC, here's another one. Greg Sankey is determined to plow ahead with the SEC with SEC football one way or another.
Believe it or not.
I don't believe that, Jeff. You're now starting to hear a little bit of backtracking from Greg Sankey on this
matter. What did he say? Let's hear it.
Here's what he said yesterday on the Paul Feinbaum show about whether or not the SEC would indeed play football if they're the only conference. This is why you can't have a computer.
I was asked a question, and I think if the entirety is played, I spoke when this flared up of the connection between the Autonomy 5 conferences being likely stronger than I've ever experienced. We're speaking every day. But even more importantly, our schedules are connected. So the notion that one lightly thinks about going off and doing something in an independent way is actually not attached to reality.
A lot of buzzwords.
I still think they do. Yeah, that's a lot of legal talk, a lot of mumbo jumbo there. I still don't believe him. I mean, I believed him. If push comes to shove, is the SEC going to sit out football because those namby-pamby Californians do?
No, I do think there are other complications if they're playing, you know, for instance, what does the schedule look like? Are they, you know, for instance,
they could literally just play an SEC schedule and be done with it.
You know, but now we're talking about, hey, universities are going to, I understand the SEC is the richest, you know, if not the richest conference in college football, it's the second richest conference. And, you know, if they're playing and then they have to rearrange their schedule and they get rid of bye games, you know, like Auburn gets rid of the Kent State game, whatnot, they're probably going
to. Of course, they get rid of bye games anyway. The whole point of bye game is to have a home game for the fans. There's no fans. You don't need a bye game.
Correct. But I imagine you're also going to play Kent State.
Maybe there's some force majeure thing in the you know, act of God thing in the contract with Kent State. But you don't. I don't know. Yeah. I think they are likely to go. Here to me, it really to me goes back to the larger question of what's happening with students in colleges generally.
Yeah.
Right. And one of the things I was talking to Charles about today was the liability issues there. In the end, because I have been on the side of colleges will be open because they have no choice. Not because it necessarily makes sense, not because it's a smart thing to do, not because it's safe, not because any of those things, but they will be open because they will go belly up
if
they aren't
open.
They have bills to pay. Someone pointed out to me recently, I was talking to a college, someone who's involved in the college universe, that a lot of these places that have built new dorms, Yeah. They've gone into debt to build dorms. Yeah. Colleges have to pay continuing payments on construction loans that they built dorms, and the way they do that is by rooming fees, etc. Like they're
if you want to stay in the nicer dorm, you got to pay the whatever the
premium. And they're and that's because the university didn't just build that with cash. They have their own loan that they are paying down on the because of the construction, their own construction loan. So I didn't know that. I hadn't thought about that. But the point is, universities have bills to pay, so I think they will open up. But Charles made the point that if you've got 100 kids who are test positive for COVID, and you can't imagine there won't be, right? And some of them go in the hospital, or sure, some of them, ultimately, I understand kids aren't basically at much at risk here, but if you've got 30,000 kids,
sure,
someone will die. If you've got 30,000,
statistically speaking, it
someone
seems
will
likely
die. Just like someone would have died from alcohol poisoning or sure, whatever else. It's not a reason. I'm not saying that's not a reason to do it.
Correct.
But whoever dies, and someone will, that person is going to sue the university.
It's been the same reason why when everyone talks about all these plans for sports returning, I want to know what the attorneys are saying and the general counsel is saying.
I think the general counsels and attorneys will have a lot to do with this. Now, Congress could, and this is one of the interesting things.
Sure.
Right now, there is because the economy continues to languish, there's a question on the Hill of what do we do, what next do we do to prop up the economy? And Democrats say, well, we got to send out more checks. That's what Democrats are saying. We got to send checks to states. Which, as you recall, with the last time they were refilling the small business coffers,
replenishing,
the Republicans said, we'll deal with the state stuff. We don't want to do that now. Let's just go ahead and replenish the small business loan money because we know we want to do that. Let's do that. We'll take up the bailing out the states, which are desperate for money, later. Well, now that it later has come, Republicans, whatever, well, you can agree or not, don't want to give money to the states, and they don't want to give people another $1,200 check. What they want to do is pass legislation, or one of the ideas is to pass legislation that would remove the liability from small business owners that open their businesses, right?
Yeah.
They're like, let's protect small businesses from being sued for COVID-related illnesses from either customers or employees, et cetera, and that's how we will get the economy going again.
Yeah.
Democrats want to pour more money into people's pockets. That's just the way that's right now. It seems to be one of the issues of debate. But one thing that that Congress could do is they could remove the liability from universities. They could do this wherever they want. Like they can pass legislation that helps to solve these liability issues. And in the end, it's going to be very hard to separate college sports from colleges. It's one of the advantages that pro football has and the NBA have. They don't have to worry about this. They don't have to worry about people who live in the community. They don't have to worry. They're just worrying about their players and the fans and how that all
works. Well, and they don't have to protect the notion of amateurism.
And they don't have to protect this notion that it's all part of the university and that we care mostly about the player's safety and everything else in the community and kumbaya and amateurism. Exactly right. So, okay. Penny Hardaway was on with GP yesterday. Penny Hardaway benefits in recruiting because of his appearances on The Last Dance.
Believe it or not.
I'll say I believe that. In general, this is one of the, in terms of a sports watching experience, this is, you know, from a ratings perspective, almost a phenomenon.
I don't really believe it. Not in any meaningful.
It can't hurt.
Let's hear Penny. Let's hear a little Penny on, this is on playing Jordan, I think, in the third game back. Jordan's third game back.
Penny, you played against MJ his third game back. I don't know if you remember the game. I'm guessing you do. You had 22. Mike had 21. Talk to us about that, like the lead up, your first time playing against MJ. What was that night like?
I was hyped because we was the new kids on the block, bro. I mean, think about it. We was rolling. Like, that was our year. So with Mike coming back, I was like, okay, talk to Shaq. And like, man, it's on. I'm going to get a chance to play against MJ. And you could tell when he came back that he wasn't. I knew the difference now. Don't get it twisted. We understood coming back from baseball, from where he was right before he retired. So, but still, to be on the floor with him, it was crazy because I kept looking at him like, damn, he came back and he's actually out here. So that was a fun night for me.
It's nice to see Penny, and it's a reminder of how awesome Penny was.
Yeah, there was a dunk that he had, and you're like, God, before the injury, that guy could just play this game.
That's the thing. He was not just skilled, he was savage.
Yeah, he was a freak.
He really, it is too bad that did not have the career he should have had. But I don't actually think in any meaningful way it really helps. There's not a huge lot. Penny appears in glimpses there. I just have a hard time believing that a recruit says, you know, I'm going to go to Baylor, but there's Penny Hardaway in a 20-year-old clip. And so, you know, they already know Penny's an icon. I just don't believe it. There's a lot of things that matter in recruiting. Money. but I don't... I think Penny being Penny matters. At writ large, Penny being Penny matters, right? Penny being Penny Hardaway, icon, all of that matters. I don't think the fact that he's appearing on The Last Dance really matters. All right, finally, to bring this show back around, Mount Rushmore of chips. Pringles belongs on a Mount Rushmore of chips.
Believe it or not.
Absolutely not. They might belong on the Mount Flushmore of chips.
Well, okay, what is the Mount Rushmore? Is the Mount Rushmore of chips the greatest chips or the most iconic chips?
I don't think Pringles applies to either.
Okay, well, look.
Pringles is a gimmick.
All right, let's discuss, okay? I think we can agree. I'm going to take some of that I think is totally non-controversial, okay? Doritos belongs on the Mount Rushmore of chips. And it belongs on the Mount Rushmore of chips, not in the Cool Ranch variety.
Yeah, but
in the
nacho
regular
cheese.
Nacho cheese.
It's belongs. an iconic and versatile chip.
Okay. Lay's belongs on the Mount Rushmore of chips, not because they're good, because they're not that good, but because it's the potato chip of America. Like, it is the iconic American potato chip.
Yeah, at a certain point,
I prefer a Ruffles Ridge, don't you?
I don't know if I'd go that far, but at a certain point...
You don't
point,
like a Ruffles Ridge?
I would rather have a bag of Lay's than a bag of Ruffles.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Taste.
Yuck. But I think... But anyway, everyone would have to put Lay's on there, right?
At a certain point, you do deserve credit for being first.
And great.
Yes.
Are they first? Yeah, just being being the number. Like, they're just... And yeah. Like, it's like... You may not like Coke... But it belongs
sure.
on the soft drink.
Yes.
It belongs on the soft drink Mount Rushmore.
Yes.
I think the next one that has to go up there is Cheetos.
Okay.
Well, you tell me what else goes up there. Cheez-Its?
Is that a chip?
Okay, I don't know.
So this is snack. Are we going
pretzels?
Snacks?
Salty snacks. Yeah, Doritos. Yeah, okay.
Well, then I'm going Flavor Blasted Goldfish Extra Cheddar.
Oh, yeah, but that's not, it doesn't
Goldfish.
Belong.
Goldfish.
That's an interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's say we're restricting it to chips. Because then let's say we're restricting it to chips. What else is there?
I think you have to put Ruffles on there.
A second potato chip?
I mean.
You think Lay's, Ruffles, Doritos?
I mean, are you.
And Cheetos?
Are you going to put.
Oh, Pringles is a potato chip. I would never. I
not,
hate
not according to not according to lawsuits.
I hate Pringles, but my question is: is it iconic enough that it belongs on the on? I think that Pringles is really a crappy chip.
Mm-hmm.
How about a pretzel?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a pretzels guy.
I hate pretzels.
I think in general, a pretzel is in its finest form when you.
But is that a chip?
I think it's a snack. Like, that's the thing. Are we distinguishing? If pretzels, if you're going to allow pretzels, you have to allow.
What's Cheetos, though? If you're going to allow Cheetos, how can you not allow Goldfish? Cheetos isn't a chip.
That's my point. Like,
it's a noodle.
I'm being consistent
thing.
With all. I'm saying if
yeah,
you're
okay, so we're going salty snacks then. If we're putting Cheetos up, if you're doing just chips, it's Ruffles, Doritos, Lay's, and what's the other one?
I guess a tortilla chip?
Yeah, no. Those are Johnny Come Lately chips in America. A Frito. Frito.
Yeah, there we go.
Is it a chip?
Sure.
It's clear Frito. I think we got a winner.
It's technically a corn snack.
I think you got... It's chippish, though.
Yes, it's chip adjacent.
I think it's... I think if you're going chips, you got to go Frito,
mm-hmm.
Lay's, Ruffles, Doritos.
Jeff, thank you. Thank you for your service.
We agree?
Yes.
Now, salty snacks.
Goldfish.
So you're bumping, you're putting Lay's and Doritos still on there.
Yeah, I think they I think they still belong.
How about a Frito? Goldfish and Frito?
Yeah.
Or Cheeto? Which is better, Cheeto or Frito?
Personally, I'm a Frito guy.
I'm talking about iconic place in American history.
I think Frito's has a unique, Cheetos feels like a kid's snack. Like, it feels like after you get to be 12.
Cheetos obviously outranks Fritos because we looked at the numbers earlier. Which seems crazy to me, by the way.
I can buy. I just think in general, Cheetos go in like every 8-year-old's lunch.
Well, and that makes them iconic then, doesn't it?
No, because then you discover the chili cheese Frito and you decide, I'm never eating Cheetos ever again unless I have to. Or
no, I eat the baked, what are those things? The crunchy Cheetos. Really good.
Yeah, same thing, though. Okay, I put a bag of chili cheese Fritos.
But we're talking about iconic, not which is better. I would never in a million year pick a Cheeto over a Frito. Always Frito over Cheeto. But that doesn't mean in the iconic American consciousness that a Frito's bigger than a Cheeto. But you think it's Lay's, Doritos, Fritos, Goldfish. I'm willing to, in the interest of peace, I'm willing to go with.
It was a kiss.
Chris Harrington joins us now. Chris, what are we listening to?
That is Such a Night by Elvis Presley from his 1960 album, Elvis is Back! His first album after returning from a 2-year stint in the Army. An album that turned 60 years old this spring and which I put into the Essential Memphis Library today.
I've never heard that song before in my life. I like it. Is it a not particularly? Have I just missed it and it's been sailing all around me, or is that a lesser known?
No, Elvis is Back. The album is sort of the lost classic in Elvis's discography, I guess. In that, you know, he came back from the Army and his first public appearance after the Army was on the Frank Sinatra Show, a Welcome Home Elvis edition of the Frank Sinatra Show, and it was him and Frank both in tuxes, like singing. And there was this sort of idea of him returning not as a rock and roller, but sort of as this sort of new generation Sinatra kind of crooner. And that album, Elvis is Back, is sort of in that vein. It's sort of a post-rock and roll version of what that would be. But he didn't really follow through on it. After that, he went and did silly movies and sang silly movie songs and ended up in a jumpsuit. And, like, it was sort of a road not taken. And I actually think one of my pet theories is that we think of Elvis as this revolutionary rock and roll creature, but he was probably really more in the lineage of interpretive singers like Bing Crosby and Sinatra and Billie Holiday than he was a pure rock and roller like Chuck Berry or Buddy Holly or whatever.
Is the reason that he did silly movies and ended up in a jumpsuit and all that, was that how he was wired, or was that his management saying?
That was his management. I mean, that is the popular theory, and I believe the correct one, that his career was essentially mismanaged by his manager, Colonel Tom Parker, who was a very old-school, carny kind of guy, and that he pushed Elvis in directions that he thought would be more lucrative and for Elvis than let Elvis follow whatever his artistic or musical views was. Yeah.
Yeah, because there is there's the caricature Elvis, like, and that's too bad. What's the name of the album again? What's it called?
Elvis is Back.
Elvis is Back. Is it a particularly good album?
I think it is. I mean, he was more of a singles artist than an album artist, but I think there are three studio Elvis albums that I would say, if you're putting together the Elvis collection, these are the three studio albums, like, you know, as they were released at the time, that should be part of that collection. And that's his very first one for RCA, just called Elvis Presley from 1956. That's Elvis is Back from 1960. And that's from Elvis in Memphis, his first album he made out of his Memphis sessions in the late 60s.
So his first album was in 1956, and he came back?
His first album, yeah.
When was his first single?
He first recorded at Sun in 1954. So he was releasing singles on Sun in 1954, 1955 as a regional independent artist. And then he signed the contract with RCA and put out his first album for RCA in 1956.
And the Army was 58 to 60? When was the Army?
Yeah, generally speaking, 58, spring of 58 to spring of 60.
And we had a draft then. Is that the idea? He was drafted.
Yeah, I believe he was drafted. I'm pretty sure he was drafted.
Yeah, he was drafted. Yeah, he was drafted on us. Because this was pre-Vietnam. It was, you know, whatever.
I mean, it was sort of a rite of passage kind of thing. I mean, much, much larger percentage of the male population served in the Army then.
I got you. All right, well, there you go. There's your Elvis primer for the day. You wrote about the Grizzlies and the possible return to the NBA and all of that. What did you make of yesterday's news?
Well, it kept changing throughout the day. And so, I mean, I originally put up a story, you know, late afternoon, and that was before the apparently Adam Silver's call to board of governors. So I updated it this morning. You know, at this point, it's still mostly filtering through leaks from the league office and the Players Association. When John Morant responded to those leaks by tweeting, "I want to play," like, you know, John Morant does not believe in the secret ballot. He was like letting us in on the vote. At that point, it became more of a local news peg, and so I went ahead and did something on it at that point. I think there's still a lot of uncertainty. I mean, I think, you know, when we talked, I think on Monday, I mean, the news of the weekend was, oh, you know, we're getting more pessimistic. Let's turn the dial to the left towards the not playing. And I think now we've turned the dial back to the right, but I don't think the dial is completely to that end either. When Adam Silver says, you know, we'll make a decision in the next 2 to 4 weeks, that doesn't mean they're going to be playing games in the two to four weeks. That means they'll make a decision. And so I think you should assume that if the decision is to move forward, which I think is more likely than not, that when that decision is made in 2 to 4 weeks, there's another 2 to 4 weeks before you see basketball, would be my assumption.
One of the things that you touched on in your piece today, and again, people can read it at the Daily Memphian, I have tweeted it out, is the financial implications of all of this. And I haven't sort of sorted through it, but you raised...
Yeah, and I didn't wade into it. It's too complicated. I just sort of... I wanted to acknowledge it.
Just to get a sense of it, if I can, one of the things that you raised was the idea that there would be massive luxury tax bills on the one hand for some. How would that work that there would be? Because the...
massive luxury tax bills if the current system is left in place to just function how it would function, right? If the systems and mechanisms are allowed to just operate the way they would normally based on these new inputs, and the new outputs would be like massive luxury tax bills.
And that would be why? And explain to the folks why that would be?
Because the contracts are on the books for multiple years, you know, essentially guaranteed contracts. There's a little wiggle room in that. But essentially guaranteed contracts for multiple years. But the luxury tax line is recalculated every year based on the previous year's revenues projected into the next season. And so the whole system is set up on the assumption of relative stability and really sort of relative growth. There's an escrow system. I don't know the exact percentage offhand. I think it's 10%. A certain percentage, even though contracts are guaranteed, a certain percentage of player contracts are held in an escrow account, and they either get the money or they don't based on the league revenue. So that mechanism allows for responsiveness to sort of change in the system. Like what happened with China, right? Like that mechanism will smooth out that. So maybe if the league takes enough of a hit, like that 10% of player salaries actually doesn't go to players, and so that escrow mechanism sort of is designed to deal with significant bumps, but not like this. And so what you could have is a situation where the luxury tax line, because of revenues, maybe drops by $40 million. Well, that's a lot bigger than the escrow system can handle, so now you all have all of these, you know what I'm saying?
I want to clarify for the folks. So you have this escrow system because the way it works between the players and the owners is that they agree
players are guaranteed
a certain amount, 51% of league revenues, but you don't know what that's going to be exactly in a given year, and so they put this money aside in the escrow, and it either goes to the players or not. They're not getting their full salaries, whatever. Some of it is tucked into this escrow, and that can handle if the revenues take a hit like they did when the China money went away. That could handle that. If 40% of league revenues are gone, the luxury tax line will all of a sudden be dramatically lower, and you have all these teams that were not in the luxury tax are now, quote-unquote, paying luxury tax, including, I'm sure, the Grizzlies. Would, in that instance, be, quote-unquote, paying luxury tax?
Yes. Yeah, because
that's not going
to
happen.
Operate right up to the line, right?
Yeah.
But I would guess, and I know one from the Grizzlies has told me this, but I would guess that the bigger concern for a team like the Grizzlies would be the impact on revenue sharing, because there wouldn't be revenue sharing, right? Or there may not be revenue sharing in that circumstance if these major market teams like don't have their revenue. You know, if the Lakers don't have their big local TV contracts or whatever. And so it's chaos all the way around. If that, what Adam Silver said, our CBA is not set up to handle something like this, he's right. I mean, you know, he knows more than me, but I can tell you he's right. Like, the CBA is set up on the idea of relative stability, relative growth, or even like relative declines. It's, the system is designed to function. The system can't function if there's a 30%, 40% revenue decrease. So they're going to have to rewrite the rules, basically. They're just going to have to for the league to function. And that's not about finishing this season. That's about planning for next season. And that's sort of the thing. Like, everyone's focused right now on, are we going to finish this season? But the bigger, more complicated question is the one after that, which is next season.
And that's because we simply need it. They're going to have to go back and negotiate a new financial structure moving forward.
Yeah. And the system will collapse. It can't. The current system can't function in this climate. Yeah.
And who knows how that will impact, I mean, at the granular level, what the Grizzlies do with D'Anthony Melton. I mean, there's no way to possibly know.
We've been talking about, like, we had this conversation not too long ago, right? The mid-level exception will be this amount of money, but, like, we don't, like, just throw that all out the window right now. Like, we don't, because that's all tied to revenues. And so we really don't know what the situation's going to be.
Yeah, it's funny. It always struck me as strange, this idea that they were polling players yesterday. And then, of course, the Players Association denied they were polling players, even as you point out, Ja Morant was voting very publicly that he wants to play. But the whole thing, in the absence of context, I don't even know what that would mean. Like, do you not want to play if it means that you don't get another, you know, that revenues collapse by another 50%? Do you not want to play? If you ask me, I said this on Gary's show, do I want to do a radio show this morning? I would probably say, not if I'm getting paid not to do a radio show this morning, but I mean, so the whole thing makes, I find it hard to believe, because most people between 20 and 30 aren't that concerned with safety, their own personal safety. And I find it hard to believe that too many players are really worried about that in particular.
Probably not. Although, I mean, it's sort of, on one hand, A, you have sort of younger players, younger people, younger, healthier people, who are competitive and who want to do this, and their careers are only so long. And so the idea of losing a season, like, that's a big chunk of what you're doing. On the other hand, they are all rich. And so, I mean, there is somewhat less of a...
They don't have to work.
How rich and how they manage their money or whatever, there is somewhat less of a...
Right.
Like, it's not the factory worker who's like, if I don't have this paycheck, well, you know, what am I going to do? It's not that.
Yeah. Okay, last question, totally apart from the NBA. One of the things that's now being discussed, and I forget what's involved in phase two. Maybe I'll talk to you more about this tomorrow. But after 14 days, you can move into phase two. So... Monday, it will be 14 days. Phase two, I don't know what phase, I should look up what phase two allows that phase one does not allow. My sense of it is that they're not going to say, okay, it's Monday, phase two. What they're going to say is, okay, we're starting to get the data from phase one, and we need 10 to 14 days to even begin to get the data in to see what's happened. I can imagine if things go well, and I'm purely speculating here, that by the end of next week, we might be moving into phase two. I would find it hard to believe that we just declare we're into phase two Monday. Wouldn't you? Just off the...
I think, and I just like you, I've been meaning to go look and see what's the actual differences, because we keep sliding on all this anyway. Like, you know, the
haircuts were in phase two,
one anyway, and here they are. And like, the individual attractions, you know, like the zoo, or like basically outside of the city, like, because they're like doing their own individual plans that either are approved or not approved. So I'm not sure how material the real differences are going to be from phase one to phase two. I do feel like, I think so much of this now is about sort of public messaging and trying to encourage or discourage behavior. And I think it would be a mistake to immediately go into a phase two as soon as that 14-day thing hits, because the messaging was, we will wait a minimum of 14 days before we will consider going into the next phase. And you don't want people to take that as it's just a set clock. Okay, it's 14 days, and now like everything's different again. So I think for multiple reasons, one of them being just to as a signal of like cautiousness, I would hope that they would not immediately go into a phase two. Also, it seems to me unlikely that the metrics would warrant their own stated metrics would warrant moving into a phase two immediately anyway.
Yeah. I mean, so far the metrics have been good, but they reflect nothing from any of what's happened.
Reflects more stability, though. It doesn't reflect, to me, right. I haven't looked closely, but it seems like it reflects more of a stability than an advance, necessarily.
Right. Yeah. I can see that. Okay. Thank you, Chris. We'll talk to you more tomorrow. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
It's that time again on 92.9. Jeff and Jeffrey have kept you hanging long enough. It is, at long last, the one story you've been waiting for.
Well, in the meantime, in the midst of all this college football stuff, hear what Paul Feinbaum said today?
That this situation is an opportunity for the Power Five to break away and start
exactly.
its own thing.
Exactly. He said the reason that Mark Emmert is sort of said, Mark Emmert, of course, head of the NCAA, the reason that he said we're not going to set an arbitrary date for all these conferences when they can start and when they can't start is because, A, he doesn't have the power to do that anyway.
Correct. Big part.
They're kind of irrelevant when it comes to college football. The NCAA is kind of irrelevant.
They do not control the postseason.
And they don't have the power to say, college football can't start in such, like, commissioners treat Mark Emmert like he's dust on the shoulder, like dandruff dust on the shoulder.
Correct.
You know, like,
basically, their only power in college football is determining whether or not a player's eligible.
Yeah. And so, Paul makes the point that the Power Five is looking to leave anyway. Like, screw the NCAA. Let's break off and just run our own thing. Now, if they do, I don't at that point know why schools like Memphis should schedule them anymore. Like, that's fine. Like, they can just schedule each other and play each other, et cetera. I don't think it will be a good thing for American sports if the Power Five just break off. But it will not surprise me, because what have we seen? We've just seen where there is more money, you go for the more money. Right?
Yes.
And now, particularly at a time when their money is going to be short for everybody, that drive to get ever more money is going to be all that much more acute.
I think two things on this matter. Number one, I don't think this is as likely. I'm not saying that Paul's, you know.
It's not immediate. It's not going to happen immediate. But will it be an impetus to break off?
No. And I think the biggest reason why is, obviously the biggest reason would be for money for television deals. The idea, if you get better games, the TV networks will like that better. That's not necessarily the case. What TV networks like is
lots of games.
They want volume. And so they don't really care.
That actually is an interesting thing. If the NCAA, if the Power Five broke off, the group of five?
Yes.
They would have their own TV contracts.
Correct.
And they would be selling their own games. And people, what you discover is people just watch football. You're exactly right. People want content. And they want to watch BYU play. And they want to watch Memphis play. And they want to, people will pay to watch. I don't think it would be awful for Memphis if that happened.
And then the other biggest reason why I do not think it'll happen, inevitably, when you play, if you're going to play all Power Fives, it's going to do a lot. You know, the odds are your roster is going to get banged up more. Coaches are going to really push back on this big time.
They like to have their bye games.
They like to have their bye games.
They like to have their winning records.
And they care about their records.